the people that want to set up a national police force decided that you people are too sharp and would catch on if they tried to do it again through the government. So what they've done is the think tanks in Washington, D.C. funded a plan and a proposal to standardize every police agency throughout the area through the private sector. So we now have about six police organizations from around the nation and actually some international police agencies. One is the International Police Chiefs Association, which is a very leftist organization, and they're the ones always the gun lobbyists always quote as, look, police officers are for taking the weapons away from citizens. Look at the International Police Chiefs Association, what they think. And they're a very leftist organization. So they always quote their figures and have their spokesman speak. But they, along with the National Sheriff's Association, an association, I may have the name wrong, but it's something like Association of Black Police Administrators, and about three others that joined together, and all of a sudden this marvelous plan came out of all this, these police private organizations, that we were going to start accreditation of all police agencies throughout the United States. And all of a sudden, all the universities across the United States in their police science divisions, the kids began to hear the word accreditation. Is your police department accredited? Is your police department accredited? Well, mine's not accredited. What's accreditation? Well, if they're not accredited, they're nothing. If you're not accredited, you're a low-life police agency, and you're not professional. And so now in the media, in the newspapers, in all the colleges across the nation, in the police science departments, there's this hollering about, if you're not accredited police agency, you're not professional. And now the hype is that if you want a professional police agency and you're not accredited by CALEA, and that's the Commission on Accreditation of Law Enforcement Agencies, you're nothing. Now in Texas, there's a couple agencies here that have already passed their accreditation, and a number of them are in the process. It's a lengthy process where I think they pay something like $12,000 to $24,000 to get into this private accreditation program. And then they send these specifications out and all of these guidelines where your agency has to start promoting this type of standardization across the country. And in Phoenix, Arizona, one of the first agencies and the largest agency to be accredited was my department, the Phoenix Police Department, under Chief Ortega. He was one of the instigators that helped start this thing. And so it's what it is. Several attorneys have looked at it and said the same thing I said, that the guidelines are so loose that all you have to, and the guidelines now are so mundane, they're just little things like, well, you have to use a certain kind of handcuff, and you got to do just little frilly things that really don't make too much difference anyway. But it's the standardization process being started to, as the attorneys said when they looked at it, that these guidelines can be changed at any moment, and things installed in these guideline places that are completely totalitarian in nature, to where in one location in this country, someone could step in and run every police agency across the nation overnight. So watch out for CALEA. There's nothing being said about it but all this wonderful hype that, boy, if your agency isn't involved in CALEA, they better be, or they're going to be blackballed from the police community around the nation. It started in the small departments, and now some of the larger departments are beginning to join the accreditation program. That's the thing that I'm looking into. I'll report more to you through Aid and Abet News as I get more in this investigation. I'm trying now to dig in and find out what think tanks and what organizations started this initial funding of this program. And I've heard some scuttlebutt, but I won't give that to you because I haven't been able to prove it yet, about some of the agencies or private foundations that you would recognize the names that could possibly be behind this thing. So I'll be working on that, and I'll keep you informed if you can get a hold of us. If you don't get on our mailing list, then well, you should, because it's not that much, and we can keep you up on this stuff. And if you don't want to do that, then just write to me occasionally and ask me what we know about CALEA, and I'll see if I can get back to you. But you check into it. Get into it in your area. Call up your police chief. Ask them if they're in the accreditation program yet. And starting some rumblings on this, and I'll try to feed you information as I find out more. I don't have too much more time, but I want to cover just two other things with you. One is, if there's officers here, and they're saying to me, and saying to themselves especially, what have we lost? What rights have we lost? This is still America. We still got our rights, all this thing. I want to touch just briefly on the driver's license issue. Now, I think most of you here know about this, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time on it. But for any officers in the audience here that don't understand how we have lost rights just all along, and every week we're losing more and more rights, this is a good one that will hit right to the heart of any police officer. We are trained from the first day in the academy that driving is a privilege. Traveling is a privilege. You getting in your vehicle and going down the street and going about your daily activities to the store to get bread, to go to work and come home, is a privilege granted to you on good behavior by the government. And we're taught that from the very beginning. And it's shocking to police officers that I communicate with this newsletter here. It's special issue number 11. It was issued specially to police officers. When I found the case law that you guys gave to me, there's a guy sitting in the back of the room here, Bruce McCarthy, that sent me quite a bit of this material on the fact that we've always had the right to transport ourselves from one place to another. That's a basic right that we've always had. I didn't know that as a police officer. I've written tickets for no driver's license and all these things over these years because I believe that indeed it was a privilege that was granted by government. So I was shocked by this, and I wrote a newsletter on it. And it's really caused a stir among certain agencies within the United States. Because, number one, when I say that it's factual, that we really did have a right, and we do have a right now to travel, as long as we're not doing business, we're not involved in commerce, on the roadways, we have a right to travel without any infringement on that right, as long as we're doing it safely. Now, if you get out there like a maniac and running over people and chasing kids out of school zones and everything, that's not what we're talking about. But we're talking about a good citizen out about his daily activities has a right, a basic fundamental right to travel without any infringement. This has upset the law enforcement community, not because you're saying it, because you're a bunch of crazies anyway. But when a law enforcement person, they think, you know, hey, man, we don't want to listen to these guys. But when a police officer and it really helped that I did so well with the police department and earned quite a national name for myself before I got into this, because now I have a certain amount of credibility with other officers. And when I wrote this newsletter, and you've used it so well by getting copies of it and handed it out to the police officers you see, it's blown their minds. I mean, it's incredible the letters I get from police officers about it. They don't want to believe it. They can't believe it, but it's here in black and white. Listen, any officer sitting out here, you guys probably already heard this, but even this is a case. It's called Chicago Motor Coach versus Chicago, and it says here, even the legislature has no power to deny it to a citizen the right to travel upon the highway and transport his property in the ordinary course of his business or pleasure. Another case, the right of the citizen to travel upon the public highways and transport his property thereon, either by carriage or by automobile, is not a mere privilege which a city may prohibit or permit at will, but a common right which he has under the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know what this does to the law enforcement agencies in the country? I mean, these are court cases. This is case law. This is what the criminal justice system lives on. Its life's blood is the case law, which is incorrect in itself. But, I mean, if that's what their life blood is, they can't handle this, especially when police officers begin to bring it up to them and say, hey, what about this? I got an oath. You know, I'm supposed to be protecting the laws, and I thought this was a privilege. And they're beginning to ask questions. Thanks to you folks, not because of me, but because you sent me the names of officers, handed out this newsletter, and you're causing such a stir you wouldn't believe it. They're going to have to deal with these things one day, and I think it may be soon. I don't know what they're going to do, but they're really frustrated. So that's issue number 11, and if you haven't seen it, pick it up. But there's more cases here, but it tells you in black and white that this is the law, that it is your right. The last thing I want to take a moment on is that for those that may be new here and don't understand the seriousness of the people once again gaining control of their police officers in their community and making them once again peace officers and taking them out of the realm of enforcement officers for a new society, which they're geared for now and being prepared for. I quote to you the case that I've been working on since 1983 of one, and it's just one case, of the of a group of people called, that I call public enemy number one in this nation. And it's obvious to me that you folks right here, beyond any terrorist, beyond any rapist, robber, you name it, murder in our society, you folks have to be public enemy number one to this form of government, and I'll tell you why. There are no other groups that I have seen in a decade of law enforcement, or no other individual in a decade of law enforcement, that officers are being allowed to execute so fast and so quickly as a person calling themselves an American patriot, Christian, freeman, constitutionalist, or any other such name. You're the only ones. You are the ones. We now have at least four cases that I've looked into, one extensively that I looked into, another one I just finished in California, where a person who was a patriotic leader in California was shot down at his door, killed, right on his doorstep in front of his wife and child. And basically it was because he was a leader. He was the leader of a patriot organization in California. That's only been recently. You probably aren't even aware of it. But I've worked barricade situations for 10 years where I've waited days, and we poured thousands of dollars and man hours into trying to rescue some creep that has killed people, or crazed dope addict that has killed somebody with any type of a weapon you can believe it. We will spend days and thousands of man hours to get that guy out of a building so he can be rehabilitated. But you let it be you. You let it be a political, moral individual that our government cannot cope with, and you're in serious trouble, because we have at least four cases now where individuals just like you and I say you and I because I'm a part of you, that politically, morally, and religiously could not tolerate what its government was doing, and they were trying to redress their grievances in a nonviolent fashion. And they were shot down by police officers almost immediately upon the officers arriving at the scene. No chance to surrender, no barricade situations that they spent days trying to talk you out so you can be rehabilitated. And here's my point. I praise God that every one of you in here are not rehabilitatable over such things as our nation, our God, and our posterity. We have a very sad, sad case. And in 1983, I was a police officer that was a training officer certified to teach in the Regional Academy in Arizona, Police Academy in Arizona. And I got a report that a farmer, a 63-year-old farmer, had shot two U.S. Marshals in North Dakota. And it was my job, as other training officers around this country, to review the deaths of any officers that happened in this nation and find out why they died, and so we could learn why these officers perished and teach our officers in the academy what they did wrong. Monday morning quarterbacking, yes, but it was our job. So I reviewed that case in North Dakota in 1983 when a Christian patriot, radical, everything under the posse comitatus, he had every name you could imagine, that came into our department saying he was the most vicious animal the earth had ever seen, and he had killed two of our brother officers in North Dakota. And I reviewed that case and found out something very interesting, that the mistakes made by the federal officers, U.S. Marshals in this particular case, had not just led to their deaths, but the mistakes that were made exacerbated the whole violent situation. And if they had not done things in the way they had approached them, if they hadn't used the tactical approach to that situation, there wouldn't have been anybody killed. And this federal fugitive at this time, Gordon Call, who killed these two U.S. Marshals and then escaped, would never have been involved in a shootout. I found out that the U.S. Marshal shot his son and that he opened fire on the U.S. Marshals to protect himself and his family. And now he fled, and no one knew where he was in 83 in February. And as you might be aware, 4 months later, in June 3rd, 1983, he was tracked down, allegedly he was tracked down, to Smithville, Arkansas, just outside of Smithville, Arkansas, a little farmhouse. And the federal officers went in there, and the official report says that the infamous Gordon Call was barricaded in a building, in a home. Actually, they said it was a bunker. He was barricaded in an earth underground bunker, and that he had a shootout that he killed the local sheriff there, shot him face to face, just like this. The official reports, police reports that I've now read, says that Gordon Call, the federal fugitive, pointed his Mini 14 at Sheriff Gene Matthews. Sheriff Gene Matthews turned around and saw Gordon Call standing in the corner of that bunker. They faced each other and both fired their weapons simultaneously. And the sheriff hit Gordon Call in the head, right here, and killed him instantly. And Gordon Call shot his Mini 14 and hit the sheriff and killed him. He died just a short time afterwards. I was so troubled by the report that I got from North Dakota and the mistakes the U.S. Marshals made that I gathered information from Arkansas. Some of the Patriots there sent me much of that information, but also gained it through the state police and some other things, and found out that there was something desperately wrong with that shootout down there. So I had put out a call in, actually the people in Arkansas asked me to come there in 87, come there and look over the crime scene and help them get a grand jury investigation into this case. I went there and did a preliminary investigation for a couple days, was absolutely astounded by what I found, because it looked like that Gordon Call, if it was indeed Gordon Call, did not kill my fellow sheriff, Sheriff Gene Matthews, and that Sheriff Gene Matthews did not kill the sheriff. Or, I'm sorry, did not kill Gordon Call. So within 2 weeks, I assembled 9 other officers from 7 other states to travel with me back to Arkansas. And we did a pretty intensive investigation on our own, completely unofficial, but our board of inquiry looked into that, went to the crime scene, and I wanted other officers to see what I saw and tell me I was wrong, that indeed it was just like the police report said it was. But what we found, folks, is a terrible, not just a terrible tragedy, but a very, very large cover-up of the actual execution of the alleged Gordon Call by U.S. Marshals, and then the execution of our fellow sheriff for not going along with the cover-up. And we were, once again, we're police officers. We don't know these things are happening in America. When I took this team of officers back there, as much as I knew about the problems in America, that shocked me. I mean, that just turned my stomach. And here, the thing that turned my stomach the most was the fact that this case had gone all the way through the criminal justice system. It had been adjudicated, and the case had been closed without them knowing who killed the sheriff, without them even knowing if it was the alleged Gordon Call, and without knowing who killed Gordon Call. And the case is closed. And so the officers got as mad as I was, and we decided that we would pursue this thing and find out who killed who and why it was done. And we're in the midst of that investigation now. And after our initial investigation, we published a report called the Matthews Call Final Report. This was in 1987. A lot's happened since then. I won't have time to tell you about it tonight. But I have I have this final report back there. It's in a blue binder or a brown binder. And it tells what we found about the execution that was perpetrated by the federal officers. Here's one here, the gentleman has. And the investigation is 2 more years older now. We've put 2 more years into that, so that's not up to date, but there's a newsletter back there. It looks like he may have that. That's a recent newsletter on my findings after 2 more years of investigation. We have now hired 2 attorneys. We've hired a gentleman from Arkansas who's retired, who's a very high-profile attorney, retired attorney in Arkansas, that's signing on as the attorney of record. And Kirk Lyons out of Houston, I think he's Houston, Texas here, the attorney that's helped on many Patriot cases, has accepted the case for a very small fee. So he's going to be doing all the work with us to try to get a grand jury investigation. But we're in a fundraising time right now, trying to raise money to get this done. I would ask you to get that newsletter. Theresa, my helper, can tell you which one it is that brings you up to date on the final report. There it is there. What issue, what number is that?
Number 7.
Okay, Theresa. The final report will tell you about our investigation, the officers with over 180 years in law enforcement experience went there and investigated this. And every one of us say that the government actually executed this man and then executed the sheriff. But now we're out to prove it. And we've gathered enough evidence right now to prove it in a court of law that they were executed by the federal government. But the judges won't listen to us. The governor is turning his back. The state police are involved in the cover-up, so they're not saying anything. And we've written to Washington, and, of course, we're not going to get help from the FBI and U.S. Marshals because they're the ones that did it. So we'd ask your support in this investigation, but you got to know about it first. If you don't have the details, please read about it and consider helping us get finish up this investigation. Yes, sir. Yeah. Okay.
Come on. If you have a question or comment,
okay. We're about out of time, aren't we? Okay. Question. All right. Okay. Let me say, folks, that if some of you are leaving, that I just want to thank you for taking the time to come today and inviting me, because without your help and me being able to get out like this, I wouldn't be able to bring you up to date on some of the things happening. So I really appreciate it. We're going to take a few questions, but we're just about out of time, I understand.
Ask Officer McLean.
He had a good question here. Actually, it was a statement.
Yeah, it was more of a statement.
It's true.
Uh-huh. But one of the things that you if you're not aware of the Gordon Call incident, you must be aware of the fact that both Yori Call, Scott's son, Gordon's son, and Scott Fall, that did not participate in any of the shooting that happened in Medina at the time, are now in jail. They've been in jail since 1983. They were given life sentences. Two life sentences, not to run concurrently, plus 35 years by this federal judge, Benson. I think his name is Paul Benson. And what we need to do, what we really need to do, is to remember those people that are alive and try to do the best we can to get them out of that situation.
Let me tell you that I was privileged to go to Louisville, Pennsylvania, just weeks ago and testify at Yori Call's parole board hearing. And for some of you that know about this situation, he's in extremely good health. He's got an extremely good attitude. He's spending almost his whole day, except for 2 hours a day that he works. He's spending all the rest of his time studying and praying, and he's looking real good. And we're going to work extremely hard to try to get him out on parole, because he comes up for a parole hearing every 2 years. I went back and testified at this one. They totally ignored me. They aggravated me so much because I had some important things to tell them about. And I told them, I said, Yori would not be here today if it wasn't for the mistakes. And I laid out mistake number one, mistake number two, mistake number three, violations of policy within the police agency that led to this horrible shootout up there. And they totally ignored it. But we're taking it further. We're going to their bosses in the state of Pennsylvania and filing all these papers to try to get these boys out, because they don't deserve to be there. And they could have been any one of us that the government came against. So we do need to support them.
Jack, I was wondering if you was aware of the incident up in Nebraska involving Arthur Kirk.
Yes.
That got done a whole lot the same way, and do you have any intentions in the near future to looking into that incident?
Him and John Singer. There's two others, you know, John Singer and then Arthur Kirk, both. I'd like to get the time to get out and start an investigation into that, but I don't know how we're going to do it at the same time, because I have hundreds of letters coming in from police officers. We've got to go on with our educational program and this geometric progression that's working. And we've got to continue on with the call investigation. We can break that soon. And when we break that and get to North Dakota and do the investigation there and hopefully get these boys out of prison, then we'll worry about Kirk and the Singer case, where they too were shot down by police without being given a chance to surrender. But they're dead. Okay, now we have some boys in prison for life, and the officers that are working on this with me from around the country feel it's more important to try to get these people that are political prisoners, is what they are, out of jail. But we do need to work on that, and we'll get to it as soon as we can. Thank you.
A few weeks ago in the paper, my memory's bad on this, so if anybody can help me, please do. I read that there was some kind of bill in Congress that would help people pay for their college if they would serve a couple of years as a police officer. Mm-hmm. Do you know anything about that?
Yeah. I forget the name of that bill, but Senator Wayne Stump handed me that article the other day, and Senator Jerry Gillespie, who are two fantastic legislators in Arizona, and we're very concerned about that, because basically what he's talking about is there's legislation, national legislation, to fund a program like ROTC, funded by the government, but to train police officers at a very young age, young people to be police officers. I don't like it. There's a big difference between the federal armed services and what their direction is to defend the outside the United States, and taking these young people, tender minds at young ages, and to promote some of the things I see in the police academy to prepare them for enforcement against us in the United States. I don't like it a bit, and we're going to look into that, these senators and myself and some others, and hopefully file some things with the federal government and try to kick that thing open, because it's just more of the same. They want to get them at a younger age and train them up the way they would like to see them in the enforcement area. So it is a concern. It's a good point.
Mm-hmm. They're also doing that with social workers who are taking away our children. They're giving them homes and free tuition and everything to become a social worker. I have a quick statement. Someone just brought me a very old book written by a police academy professor, and he says in the book to the young officers, you must go back into your community and change the values of your community. And I wonder if you were taught this, to go back and change the values of the people.
I have not seen that. Of course, the values of the officers are being changed all the time. And that's what I've seen. I have not seen so much the officers changing the values. It sounds like NEA to me. I mean, that's where I'm seeing that. I've got a lot of material, as I'm sure you do, on the NEA and how they're changing the values of the children. But no, I'd like to read that, or if you could mimeograph it, or, you know, photocopy it for me and send it to me, I'd like to read it. They're doing today. But I don't know how the police department would change the values of the citizens, because they're not really, educational-wise, they're not involved with the citizens like some of the other agencies are. Mm-hmm.
Jack, had there been time, I would have probably illustrated my talk on jury veto power with the Darlene Spann case in Phoenix. Are you familiar with that?
Yes, I sure am.
I'd like your perspective on that. All I didn't know is what I read in the papers, as they say.
I don't know what to say. All I can say is I've got 10 cases on my desk just like that. And it's just more abuse where officers come in, totally violate people's rights, and it's another situation. It's a family in Phoenix that have been there for generations, and they're hardworking, industrious. They work hard. They don't earn a lot of money, but they've built up a little business, and officers came in and just abused them, arrested them, and actually forced them into a confrontation. And now they've been arrested for obstructing justice and assault on police officers and everything. And they were just running their business. And the officers came in and strong-armed them and get the whole family up in arms against them, not with arms, you know, guns and everything, but agitated, and to where they arrested one for absolutely no violations. And the other family members came to the rescue. Then they arrested more family members for obstructing justice, and it's a terrible thing, but it's not indifferent than what we're hearing many other places. It's something that we have to get control of, and it has to do with the training of the officers again. 90% of the officers out there, and I'm pretty close, 90% of the officers are worth saving. They're just like Jack McLam. They're decent people. And I can say that because I lost seven officers, seven friends of mine in 10 years in the Phoenix Police Department that laid down their lives for you and I out there, and they were killed trying to help save people in the community. So these are not bad people, but we need to get they're ours. They're our police officers. They're our protectors. And doggone it, we have a right to return them to the right side of this thing, and we're going to do it. And that's a good example. The Spann family suffered under the same abuse where overbearing government came in and just crushed their family. And what we're doing with aid and abet and things like that, I think will have an effect if we just keep going, Larry. And a fully formed jury amendment is probably one of the most important issues at this very moment in our country. Do you know what that would do? If we could pass in these states where the judges had to inform us of our right we already have, that jury nullification of bad law, that would solve so many of our problems in the abortion.